Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about what separates people from other animals. Not much, according to our guest here on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Christopher Lloyd. Chris is an author, a journalist. He divides his time between writing books and delivering lectures and workshops. His books include What on Earth Happened, a big seller, Absolutely Everything, another great book, and his new work is called Humanimal, Incredible Ways Animals Are Just Like Us, aimed at younger readers, but I tell you what, I learned quite a bit, and I really enjoyed reading through it and learning quite a few things, as a matter of fact, about how we share in building communities, expressing feelings and intelligence with animals. So how do you think animals are just like us? Christopher Lloyd joining us from London, right, Chris?
That's right, Larry, just south of London, actually, in Kent, in the countryside.
Oh, a beautiful area. I've been there a couple of times, and I really like it. You write books about kind of about big picture stories.
I mean, I'm fascinated in trying to connect the dots, really, of trying to, when I had younger children, they're grown up now, but when I started writing and they were younger, I realized that we are absolutely obsessed as adults in our culture with chopping knowledge up into little bits, you know, and little fragments. And at schools, it's all in curriculums and timetables and syllabuses and subjects. And that really, you know, that doesn't reflect reality. If you think about it, your brain is all about connections. You don't have a bit of sort of geography and a bit of social studies and a bit of math and a bit of music, you know, compartmentalized in your brain. That's not how it works. Your brain loves connecting things together. And when it connects things together, you get a little shot of joy, a little bit of dopamine. And so all my books are about trying to make connections between things that, you know, for some reason in our modern culture, I guess it's a post-Victorian thing, really, that we are so keen to chop everything up into little bits.
Well, it's you've done a marvelous job with this book, Humanimal, and I have a hard time saying that. I had to say it out loud many times.
You're doing well. It's good. it is a bit of a Humanimal. Actually, you can get used to it. It's trying to say in the title that humans and animals, you know, there's a lot of merit in not thinking of us all as separate species. And actually thinking about the things we have in common, not the things that divide us. And, of course, there's a message there across life and culture and everything, really, isn't there? And sometimes, if we start with the language, we can find a way of empathizing and seeing things from a different perspective that we're precluded from because of the language. And actually, one of my favorite writers of all time is George Orwell. And I don't know if you're familiar with his writing.
Oh, yes.
Listeners are, but he wrote us, if you ever want to really be inspired, read some of George Orwell's essays. And there's a very famous one called Politics in the English Language. And in that, I try and read that at least once a year just to remind myself. But he talks about how we can change people's beliefs and attitudes by changing the way we speak and the language we use. Mm-hmm. And of course, that can be to ill effect, as we're seeing in the political world today.
Yes.
Or it can be to good effect. And this is kind of new word, really, humans and animals joined together, humanimal. And if your listeners have pets or have had the opportunity to live in close proximity with our other animals, I think maybe they will be able to appreciate that the things that bind us together, the humanimal, you know, are in a way very much more profound than the things that divide us.
Yeah.
And certainly if you're a biologist and you look at our DNA, you know, it's 99% the same as a chimpanzee. It's 40% the same as a banana, I believe. So, you know, we're all kind of in this biological, you know, extraordinary biological adventure together.
I have a daughter who is 16 now, and when she has read books. She likes to sit down with a book and read, and you know, that started at a very young age, reading to her and then her learning to read herself and going on. What do books give children that perhaps other media do not?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I thought a lot about that, and funnily enough, I do think that it goes back, like so many things, to our deep evolutionary past. And my best, and it's only a personal theory, is that a book has, we receive information through reflected light. It's always light bouncing off the page into our visual cortex. With a screen, the light is emitted, and it blasts and overwhelms the visual cortex, and I think that goes down a different pathway and has a different impact on the brain. And if you think about it, through the Stone Ages and through all of prehistory, humans always receive their information through reflected light. And it's the shadows, it's the hues, and I think that's a much more natural way to learn and absorb information and to explore curiosity than by watching something that is blasting into your eyes, as emitted screens do, which, of course, is now so much the vernacular for young people. So that, for what it's worth, that's my own personal theory, and I think there's a tremendously important learning kind of paradigm in reflected light, which you get from a book.
Yeah.
I really hope people will sort of, not consign them to the sort of waste bin of history and think carefully about, it is part of the media mix.
Well, I tell you what, I would much rather have a book in my hand and read the book as opposed to having a digital version of it.
Mm.
I mean, it's such a difference.
It's a difference. And, of course, it's not just about the reflections versus the emitted light. There's the physical, picking something up. There's the leafing through the pages. There's the smell of the book. It's a bit like, if you're trying to communicate with somebody in a text, you don't get the richness of the body language you get if you're face-to-face. And in the same with a book, it's a very tactile, multi-sensory experience. And I think that there is a danger that young people, not just young people, but as we are obsessed with screens, that we lose out on that richness. Obviously, there are tremendous advantages in screen-based technology for lots of things, the immediacy, the fact that we can communicate in real time, etc. But I do think there is a mindfulness and a well-being factor about a book, which is a really important part of our mix.
Well, this book, Humanimal, Incredible Ways Animals Are Just Like Us, I love looking through this book. I not only the words, what you wrote, but the artistry in the book amazing.
He's done so well. This is Mark Ruffell, and the first book we've done together, actually. But I think there's something very special about his artwork. The style is quite contemporary, but it's very visually arresting.
Yes.
And, of course, in any book like this, one's trying to create a combination of visual and text-based information that's going to make it appealing and accessible, hopefully to, readers in this case aged 6 or 7 upwards. And, we are a visual species. I mean, that is our primary visual and oral. Those are, listening and seeing are our main kind of traditional forms of the way we take information in. And the written word is quite, new biologically. So getting this combination right means that you can talk about quite complicated things to young people if we can really use the power of visualization to bring it alive.
Well, I can certainly see that in your book, and I have to say, this book, all right, it's aimed at children, sort of, but adults, I can tell you right now, would enjoy reading
right.
it too.
Well,
was that a goal when you?
It's all about these connections, and it's not just connecting in terms of connecting subjects together or species together. Let's connect generations too, of course. If an adult is reading this to a child, or a child is reading it to an adult, then we're making the empathy flow. The story is coming out beyond the actual pages of the book and becoming something that's spoken and thought about and discussed. I had an email from a lady only yesterday in Australia, funny enough, who said she'd just been reading the book with her little boy Hugo, and they were reading about how ants milk aphids in the way that we milk cows. And that the aphids secrete a sugary solution out of their bottoms. And the ants have sort of domesticated these aphids so that the shapes of the aphids' bottoms actually suit the ants so that they can milk them more effectively, just in the way that cows have evolved through domestication with big udders that we can, you know, get milk from more easily. And he was so kind of taken by this that the idea of milking, you know, a bottom, he was hiding under the sheets and sort of making funny noises and all sorts of things. But she was saying how brilliant it was as a sort of shared experience that these stories would come alive because they're reading them to each other.
Yeah.
And of course, that's exciting to hear.
Yeah. How were you inspired just to take this particular topic up?
Well, actually, some of the previous book I just wrote a couple of years ago, well, 18 months ago, Absolutely Everything, is trying to connect everything from the beginning of time to the present day in a way so that you can get this big picture of all history, natural history, human history, connecting together. And funnily enough, one of the big questions that precipitates out of that story is, what really is the difference between humans and other living things? And it's such a big question because, you know, we're on the back of traditions in religion and in science of thinking that humans are at the apex of evolution and that we're somehow the most intelligent, the most evolved, the most wise, the most brilliant, and that the rest of creation is somehow subservient to us. And it's extraordinary how similar a religious narrative and a scientific narrative are, because, you know, science is all about manipulating the world to our benefit, and many traditional religious views have been about how the world has been there and put there for us for our benefit. But actually, you know, the more you look at what's happening around us, the more that comes into question. You know, we're not doing a terribly good job of it. You know, we have all these kind of ways in which the world is changing, not to our benefit. There are the unintended consequences surround every deliberate action. And you do begin to wonder whether actually other creatures that are able to live in a more balanced ecosystem are making a better job of it. And just because they may not be as conscious or adapted in the same way as we are, they are adapted in ways that we can't imagine. You know, my dog has got a smell, sense of smell 1,000 times better than me, even though its brain is only a tenth the size. You know, and this book is full of examples of incredible adaptations that are mind-boggling from a human perspective that warrant at least as much respect, I think, and acknowledgement in terms of their potency and their power in the story of life on Earth.
Yeah, and you have the book separated into three areas: community, feelings, and intelligence. Right.
Yeah. Right. So I was thinking to myself, if you ask somebody on the street, what defines us as human beings? What makes us human? What does it mean to be human? A human being. And as I was out talking to people about this, these were the three themes that really came out. One is that we live in groups. I mean, it's only very rarely does somebody actually want to live as a hermit on the mountaintop and never engage with somebody else. That's odd. Most people are in a family or in a tribe or in a country, or they identify with some type of like-minded people in some way. So community must be a hallmark of humanity. Feelings. Of course, you know, we cry, we clap, we scream with joy, we laugh, and you just look at the plays of Shakespeare, and all those emotions get played out on the stage, and the narratives tell you, you know, consequences of our feelings. So surely that's a key part of humanity. And finally,
intelligence,
which is probably the most obvious one. You know, we put a person on the moon. Well, we put a man on the moon. We haven't managed to put a woman on the moon yet, to our shame.
But we will, maybe.
Well, that's right. You know, I go into schools and I give my talks and I say, and how many girls in here would like to be the first woman on the moon? And all the sea of
they all raise their hands. We will be back with Chris Lloyd right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Did you know that bees vote and that some fish are farmers? The animal world is a lot like ours in many ways, and we're talking about how animals are more like us than we think with the author of a new book aimed at children, but I tell you what, adults are going to love it too. Christopher Lloyd is the author. Chris is a journalist, divides his time between writing books and delivering lectures and workshops. And his books include the best-selling What on Earth Happened? Absolutely Everything. His new work is titled Humanimal, Incredible Ways Animals Are Just Like Us. Chris, as we broke for news, we were talking about your book and how it's kind of divided up into community. We were talking about that. And feelings. Mm-hmm. Animals have feelings that sometimes match ours. And intelligence. When we broke for news, we were talking about intelligence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, if you ask somebody what makes us human, they will most often say, oh, we're very intelligent, et cetera, and we can, you know, build a skyscraper and put someone on the moon, et cetera. But actually, the levels of intelligence in the non-human world are absolutely stunning. I mean, one of my favorite examples is the slime mold. And this is a classic example of a self-organizing system. Little blobs of slime or amoeba that can exist very happily when there's plenty of food, just as little single-celled organisms. But when food is scarce, they all link together into a sort of a slime slug, and so that one of the little amoebas can then pass food along the chain to all the other ones so that the group can survive much better as a collective when food is scarce compared with when food is plentiful, and they can fend perfectly well as individuals. Well, this is a brilliant survival strategy, and there's no one leader, there's no one plan, there's no one. It all happens as a kind of self-organizing system, so much so that some researchers in Tokyo managed to show how they could get a slime mold to recreate the Tokyo subway system by putting little bits of food on all the subway stations. And then they would put the slime in the dishes, and then over a period of time, the slime would connect all itself together to all the food and then essentially recreate all the main kind of railway, subway routes over the city, because, of course, that's the way they're designed too. But nobody's telling the slime mold how to behave and you know, or organizing it in some kind of hierarchical way. It's just a natural phenomenon, which I think is awe-inspiring, really.
Yeah, it really, I was fascinated by that whole story. And you here again, visually, you've got some great examples to show that research from Tokyo. It was fascinating research to me. I loved it. And by the way, I do want to mention, too, that it's wonderful, easy reading in many ways, but it's all based on science. And you've collected a group of scientists, or you have in the book, a group of scientists. And I like the fact that you, at the end of the book, you have a section on those scientists.
Absolutely. And I think particularly given that this is a book that's aimed at younger people and their parents and grandparents, of course, it's important to be able to root all these stories into the research and the lives of real people who are out there in the field spending time watching and analyzing and researching. And hopefully these people can be role models for young people in the future, you know. And by introducing them and by exposing them through this book, I think, also gives children the kind of respect that we ought to give them in terms of qualifying the stories we're dealing with, you know, that we're in a world of fake news, aren't we now? Everything, in a way, we'd like to ground them in some reality. And by introducing them to the experts behind every page, I think we can do that. And I think there are all sorts of benefits in trying to weave that in, you know, as an important foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have David from New Richmond, Wisconsin, online. David, what's on your mind?
Hi, David.
Hey, I was observing a group of crows after the neighbors had harvested their hay, and there was one crow was in front of about five or six others, and almost as if he was definitely communicating to them. And then another crow at the end of the group that was lined up flew with that crow about 25 feet farther back from the others, and the other four kind of started hopping towards those two, and they did a little insect drive. And I swear that older, larger crow coordinated that effort there, and it was very interesting to watch. And I know corvids, the group of birds that crows belong to, are very smart birds, but it was quite interesting behavior to watch them all work together.
Oh, that's really cool, David. A comment, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, they're amazing, aren't they? Corvids, crows, and in fact, one of my favorite stories in the book, which is on page 41, I'm looking at it here, is an absolutely extraordinary research that was done in Tokyo, and also actually in Canada, where they observed crows using cars as nutcrackers. And so, and I've got some video of this. Actually, you can look at it on YouTube if you search Corvid nutcrackers. I think it'll come up. But you can see how the crows would wait on traffic lights, junctions, for the lights to go red. They would then fly down to the road and put a kind of walnut in front of a car wheel. Then they fly off, wait for the light to go green. Of course, the car runs over the nuts, cracks the nutshell, and then down comes the bird at the next red light and picks up what's inside and flies off again. I mean, how is that for spectacular adaptation to the sort of urban environment? And then they've even watched this behavior spread from one traffic junction to another. So your comment, David, about the fact that the crows are communicating with each other is absolutely right. And they're developing a culture, just like people, that is shared between different groups. So it really is a great example of human-animal.
David, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I got to tell another story relating to crows. But Patricia McConnell, who was on my program yesterday, an animal behaviorist, she one time was walking along. It had been heavy snow, and she was walking along the sidewalk, I believe, in town, and some snow falls on her head. And she walks a little further, and some more snow falls on her head, and she looks up, and she's walking under a line, like a phone line or power line or something, and there was a whole string of crows on that line, and they were, as she walked along, each one would knock a little snow off and on her head.
You know, that's amazing. Do you know what they're doing? They are doing something that us humans love to do. They are having fun. And that is it. You know, you think scientists say, well, often say, well, other species only do things for a purpose, to help their survival or to fuel some primitive appetite. But no, you know, anybody who lives with a dog knows, or a cat, that cats hunt for sport and dogs play for fun. And there's another great example of a crow, funny as it is in the book, where they've been observed sliding down snowy rooftops on a little plastic plate and going and then picking it up again and going back to the top and then sliding down again, just like, you know, that feeling of exhilaration when you're skiing downhill or whatever. Well, it's available and it's there and it's enjoyed by crows. So having fun is as human-animal as it is, as all these other things. And that's a great story, Larry.
It is indeed. And one more while we're at it, kind of showing off. You know, we kind of know in birds, and you do talk about some birds sort of showing off, but the male pufferfish creates these beautiful sand nests to attract females.
Right.
You know,
and it's very similar to our popular culture. I mean, how many pop songs are love songs? I mean, most of them are, aren't they? You know, how often, I mean, even if it's a soccer player, you know, dribbling a ball in front of the goal, you know, that skill that they have is going to be attractive to other people. And so I think, you know, a lot of these things we see in the animal world and maybe just dismiss as being, oh, it's just, you know, mate selection or whatever, is absolutely at the roots of human culture, too.
I tell you, in the little introduction when I reintroduced you, I mentioned bees voting, and I wanted to bring that back up because that's part of your whole section on community and honeybees. When they're talk about honeybees and voting.
Well, I mean, how does if you're going to live in a big community like humans do, and so do ants, and so do bees, and so do termites, live in these giant cities. How do you make a really important decision? And then this is true, of course, of you know, you've got, this is election year, isn't it, in the U.S. We just made a big decision over here called Brexit, which some of your listeners may have heard of, which is still playing its way out. And we had a referendum, and it wasn't very well managed, to be honest. And you have your electoral system, which is full of all kinds of quirks. But bees have an amazingly effective way of making a decision, which has evolved over about 100 million years, because they have to decide where to relocate their nest each year, because there are so many bees they need to sort of split. And if they get it wrong, then the survival of that colony is threatened. So they've got to get the right place. So what they do is they have these scout bees, which go off to different places within about a mile of the nest and find places that they think, or a place that they think is a really good site. They come back to the nest, and then they dance, a waggle dance. And as you probably know, that's how bees communicate. And these dances reveal the coordinates of the place that scout bee has found. And so the other bees dance with the scout bee, find the coordinates, go off to that place, have a look at it, and then they find another scout bee, and they go off to that place that scout bee has found. And then after about 2 or 3 weeks, the scout bee with the most other bees dancing with it is the one that is credited with making the right decision, and that is where the bees then relocate. And it's a type of democracy. It's called range voting. And more often than not, about 90% of the time, the research suggests, the bees choose the best possible site out of all the ones they've scouted using that system of democracy. Isn't that amazing?
It's just fascinating. Just fascinating. I was fascinated by fish as well as farmers.
Right. And again, you know, I funnily enough, I was over in Boston last week and I flew back yesterday. Often when I'm in an airplane, you look down at the ground and you see how we've transformed the landscape through farming. Of course, we couldn't have cities without farming. But then it isn't just humans that do this. This is example here in the book of damselfish, and they grow a certain type of algae on coral reefs, and they're very, very fussy about making sure that no other plant grows around it. So it's like they're like weeding their gardens, and then they're very, very protective of their algae gardens, so much so that they chase off any predators or any other fish or any other creatures that might come and eat their precious algae. And, you know, this behavior is absolutely the same as farmers. You know, we build fences, we do the weeding and pest control, and then we have a secure form of food that we know is, you know, appropriate for our species. And it's there in the animal world. It's in fish, it's in termites and ants, and it's in aphids, and it's in all kinds of different creatures. It's really interesting to see.
And I was really interested in, as well, in your comment about termites and how they build homes that are like us, and, you know, kind of like our homes in many ways.
Well, again, yeah, you could look out of that airplane and you look down at Manhattan or something. But if you were the size of a termite and you were looking at a termite's nest that might be, you know, 4 meters tall, compared with the size of a termite, that's considerably more impressive than, you know, the Empire State Building as a piece of engineering. And that's what they make. And inside there are special tunnels for air conditioning, and they design it so that they catch the wind, so that as the wind blows through the different tunnels, it kind of creates a constant temperature inside the big termite's nest. And they have chambers for the queen to lay eggs, and they have engineering ants so that if anything happens to the structure, it gets repaired. You know, they are dividing labor. They are working in a huge community in a mega city. You know, this is London, this is Tokyo, this is Los Angeles, but from the perspective of nature that has evolved. And actually, the more and more I find out about these stories and write about them, the more I see human culture as an expression of nature. And again, the divide between humans and animals, really, it's time to demolish that. It's time to think human animal.
Yeah, they have separate areas for storing food, for growing food. It was just fascinating with some beautiful artwork to show that as well. And so many ways there, animals are like us in terms of community, in terms of feelings, too. Giraffes fighting. So there's some aggression sometimes involved. There's sort of...
I mean, I've got some... Funny enough, again, you can go on to YouTube and find out and see for yourselves the aggression in male giraffes as they fight. And then one of the theories as to why they've evolved such long necks is really through combat, and you know, it's a very effective way of having a duel, having these giant long necks that can be used, you know, to whip, you know, another rival male, or an octopus that, you know, can turn a different color through anger as a warning, you know, just like humans. You know, when's the last time you see someone really angry and their face turn red? Well, we all know what that looks like, and we know what that's like. And octopuses do the same thing, you know, and a cat will, you know, will become twice its size as a way of sort of trying to sort of ward off and show its anger. Even a fruit fly, when they get angry, they puff up their wings so they can look much bigger to threaten rivals. So there is these emotions, these hormones that are coursing through the veins of all these creatures that are very, very much the same as the hormones that are coursing through our own veins. In fact, one of my favorite stories is about bonobos and about how, you know, they've been found to help each other out when they've been injured, or actually also gibbons, and how they secrete a stress hormone, cortisol, when a close relative is died or injured. And scientists have been able to measure the amount of cortisol in the poop of these gibbons. And it's just the same chemical that you would find in humans who are grieving too. So I guess it's no big surprise, because we evolved, our genes have evolved through billions of years of natural selection, not because we're humans, because we've only been humans recently. Our genes have come all the way through the river of life over all that time. So it's not surprising, really, that other creatures probably experience the world in a very similar way to us.
Well, even whales, you read about whales. Right. Who are grieving, I believe, over the death of a baby whale?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this behavior was observed off the coast of Vancouver, and a whale had a stillborn calf, and was then followed by a whole pod of other whales who were sort of mourning, and then she carried this whale for the next several days as part of a kind of ritual of coming to terms with it. And, of course, whales used to be, their ancestors were land-living creatures. About 50 million years ago, a wolf-like creature actually went back into the sea and gradually adapted to living in the sea, presumably because it was safer or that was a way of survival. And over millions of years, of course, their nose on the front of their face, like a wolf would have, has adapted to be at the top of their head, which is the blowhole, which if you're living in the water, of course, is a much better place if you've got to intake air like mammals do. And so isn't it remarkable to see how adaptive, how plastic, how fluid evolution can be? And, you know, in a way, that's a really important message for us as we think of the future, because the environment is going to change. There's going to be climate change. There's going to be rising sea levels. There's going to be all sorts of things and ways in which we're going to have to learn how to adapt to our current lifestyles in order to be able to accommodate ourselves and our humanimal relatives and cousins in the future.
Yeah, and sometimes you worry about the humanimals. The rapidness of the change, we might be better equipped to adapt to than some animals.
Well, that's right, because, of course, evolution works over cycles of generations, through adaptation, through epigenetics, through mutation, through all kinds of different mechanisms, I think scientists are discovering, that lead to adaptation in other animals. Of course, if the world changes very rapidly, that's a struggle for nature, because we are tied to nature is mostly tied to its generational cycles. Although that's where creatures that are able to adapt through reason and problem-solving and intelligence, that's why rats and corvids and monkeys and, you know, creatures that are able to adapt more quickly through using, you know, their own sense of awareness are probably going to be at a greater advantage during rapid climate change than those who aren't. Of course, the other type of living things that are very good at adapting are microbes. You know, a bacteria or a virus may have a reproductive cycle of only 20 minutes. And, of course, it can adapt incredibly quickly. Yeah. So, you know, nature works on many, many levels. And as the world changes and adapts, nature will adapt. But whether it has room for the way of life that we've grown accustomed to remains to be seen.
Well, I tell you what, this book is wonderful. We've talked about some of the things, but we have not covered everything in your book today, Chris. And it's such a pleasure to read the book, and just as much a pleasure to be able to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it,
Larry. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, your book is going to my daughter's former grade school. I'm taking my copy right there.
That's wonderful. I'm very pleased to hear it. Thanks,
Chris.
All right, take care.
Take care. We'll have him on again. He's got another book that he's working on, and when it's over, when he's finished with it, we will have him back. This is, in the meantime, take a look at the book Humanimal. And it's like the word human and animal, all one word, H-U-M-A-N-I-M-A-L, Humanimal. Incredible ways animals are just like us. In the meantime, you know what? There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. So I hope you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.